I only have a minute to tell you this. But disclaimer, the views and opinions expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show!
From Los Angeles, I'm Justin Sudeikis.
And I'm Zach Birchie. Welcome to ANCAST on this this fine pre-AX day. We should... Up front, we got to clarify something from last week. Last week, we sort of went on a tear about AX's ticketing policy for the main events, their concerts and masquerade, which are $20 additionally to your badge price when you show up if you want to get in the door. we need to clarify that that policy is apparently not new. It's been in place for a number of years, since like 2008. So it's not new. But, you know, I spoke with them, and the wording is different. It's worded now to suggest that if you don't buy tickets, the odds are fairly low you're not going to get in. Like, there's a standby line, but, you know, that's only if there's tickets left, you know, that sort of thing. In years past, you know, I was under the impression that the majority of people are in the stand-in line, and you could get reserved seating if you wanted to, but that's not the bulk of the seating. So it's worded a little bit differently, but the policy isn't new, and so that's... That needs to be said. Also, I do want to clarify that, you know, we went on and on about greed and corporate America and stuff. The SPJA is still a fan-run, by fans, for fans operation. Like, they're still volunteers. Those people are still there. Their volunteer staff up and largely quit, but the SPJA still is a volunteer, by fans, for fans operation. So whatever you think of the CEO, whatever I think of that CEO.
Which we... You know, pretty much made clear last week.
We made it clear how we feel. And this is all based on perception. You know, I mean, this is how we are perceiving things right now. I think they would do well to shift the spotlight from the CEO to the SPJA itself. Like, I think those guys should be the spokesmen and the front people for this, not their CEO. You know, that's just my opinion.
But if nothing else, they're fans.
Yeah, they're still fans. They still love it. I mean... Anyway, so that's that. We should clarify that. So what's new, Justin? Have you seen anything lately?
A whole lot of my computer desktop.
Yeah.
I am... Well, you remember how last week we made the announcement we're doing that 1,000 episodes over the summer?
Yeah.
Well, that was before I talked to Funimation, and Funimation basically just said, oh, you're posting stuff now. Great. Here is everything you missed. Mm-hmm. Can you post it so we can get you caught up? And I'm like, sure, great. And it's like another 800 episodes. Mm-hmm. So I am dying. I figured out the schedule for the next 3 months, and it will take me through the end of September. I am booked solid. I am posting like two or three new series every other day until September. Hmm. And it's good stuff, too. Like Friday, I have Gankutsu and Samurai Champloo going up, and then more Remy and Area 88. And then beyond that, I don't know, because it depends on what gets here when. But... I am so slammed. I don't know how I'm going to have time to encode all this stuff. But if you haven't watched streaming video on our site yet, please check it out, because Lord knows I want to be encoding this for somebody.
Yeah. Well, it's a good problem to have.
It is a good problem to have. And hopefully you know, this means we can really grow our traffic. I'm excited.
Cool. I finally started watching Morbido, which I borrowed from you a couple of months ago, and I'm finally getting around to it. However, it's, like, I started watching it, and I'm like, wow, this is really good, but I would rather be watching Breaking Bad right now, which I finally started watching that, too.
Yeah, of all the things to start watching while you're trying to get into a series, Breaking Bad is probably going to win. Yeah. Whatever you watch it with, it's going to win.
Yeah, so, I mean, I'm honestly, like, I'm so slammed. This is, it's sort of quiet on the site, but I'm incredibly busy in the run-up to the convention season, because it's literally one after the other this year. And I have a ton of prep work to do, so I have very little time to just watch TV or relax, and that's when I have time to watch Morbido. So it's competing for maybe a two-hour chunk of my day, and that's two Breaking Bads. I'd rather watch that. So I'll get to it. I mean, I watched about seven episodes, and it is a beautiful show. It's really well-written. I like the characters. I'm a little detached from the story. It feels a little too...
flighty.
Yeah, it's a little... Well, that, and it's very Ghibli-esque. I don't know what it is. I think it's the music and the imagery, but I get serious Princess Mononoke vibes off of this thing.
Well, yeah, it is kind of nostalgic for old world Asia.
Yeah, well, that's the other thing. Like, the last thing I watched were a couple episodes of House of Five Leaves, so I'm a little burned on the setting right now.
Oh, right. Although it's not Japan. it's very not Japan. It's not even Earth, kind of, if you zoom out far enough and see the landscape.
Right, yeah. But it's clearly Japan.
Right.
But it's a really beautiful show.
I totally fell in love with the characters. This is one of those shows where just the characterization is so rich and detailed, and sometimes that's all there is to an episode.
Yeah, you should tell people what it's about if they haven't seen it.
Okay, well, basically there's a warrior woman who is just, this unstoppable force, and she is basically out to save lives for some, shadowy reason in her past. And she ends up becoming the guardian to a prince who has to flee the palace because the crown is convinced that he is cursed and will bring drought to the land. And so she basically has to become his guardian and save him from the palace guards while he goes into hiding to save his life.
Right. And they have adventures afterward.
Right. There are quiet moments and there are lively moments. But what's really very compelling about the show is how her extended friends and this kid, this prince who is completely out of place in, the peasantry, really become kind of this ad hoc family unit.
Mm-hmm.
And it's rather heartwarming. And the prince, despite being pampered and talking princely and doesn't know how to be a commoner at all, he's really sympathetic. I really like the kid. And Balsa, the lead, is just really respectable in a way that even anime warrior women seldom are.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great character. I really like the way they're portraying her so far. So, I gotta ask, is the ending good?
I love the ending.
Okay, good.
I absolutely love the ending. It is completely satisfying, and has no loose ends.
Yeah, so often with these things, that's not the case, so...
Yeah, so often it just stops.
Apparently, I'm looking forward to seeing Eden of the East when Funimation finally puts out the Blu-ray. I'm looking forward to it. I never saw that. I heard nothing but good things, but now I'm hearing that the ending... totally shits the bed. Even those movies are apparently bad. They don't resolve anything, which is not good.
Has anyone seen the second one yet? I know the first one is...
I was hearing it came out in Japan. The second one's out. And I heard, nope, doesn't do it. It's not good. So,
mm-mm.
I don't know. I'll see for myself, but I'm excited about that show.
Well, we're getting the show streaming, so I will see it at some point.
Yeah. So, well, that's a segue. We were going to talk a little bit about this a couple of weeks ago, but we wanted to talk about sort of our shifting attitudes. There's no news this week, so we wanted to talk a bit about our personal shifting attitudes toward piracy.
It's an interesting subject because me probably more than you. I was originally a fan subber,
right?
When I was a teenager,
yeah.
And there's really pretty much no more visible role of a pirate in all of anime. Well, for me, but even beyond that, even after I went pro, I kind of took this special delight in more, I don't want to say thumbing my nose at the legality of things, but I definitely had a good time not paying for things.
Right.
BitTorrent, this was when BitTorrent was, still fairly new. And it was Wild West. You could get anything. And for a long time, after I was pro, I was that guy that, you could ask for anything and I had it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was fun. That was an ego stroke. And, I don't know what happened and I can't really pinpoint exactly when, but somewhere along the line, the collector instinct in me took over, and I think it was around the time that CPM was really, really starting to hit the skids, and it was really starting to look like a lot of stuff was going to go out of print for good.
Uh-huh.
And that's when I'm like, oh, shit, I'd better start buying things, or I may never get another chance. And luckily, everything was dirt cheap by that point, so it took me about 2 or 3 years. I ended up replacing almost everything I had either downloaded or ripped from Netflix with legal discs.
Mm-hmm.
And slowly it just became everything. I started buying software. I started paying shareware fees. It's gotten to the point where I engage in so little piracy now. And it's not like I don't pirate. I am a collector. And if you're an anime fan, and if you're a hardcore anime fan, and there is something you just cannot get, that's not an acceptable thing.
Right.
And I think anyone who's a big enough fan would understand that.
Yeah.
And so your priorities, they shift. They're not, it's not a matter of, oh, I can't get this, it would be illegal. It's, oh, well, it's illegal, but I have to have this.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I never had that. It was never about ego for me. It was never thumbing my nose at the industry. I was a pirate out of matter of convenience and ease. It was just laziness and a lack of money to buy things.
Lack of money is a big thing. I was broke at the time.
Well, yeah, I was a college kid. You don't have money in college. It's just how it works out.
I was making $30K a year living in New York City.
Ooh, yeah, that's even worse.
Yeah.
You know, so there was a time where I would just, even if it was something was just on TV that I wanted to see, I would just go download the episodes because that's the easiest, fastest way to do it. I knew how to do it. You know, we had broadband in college. It was just easy. And over time, like, it was never a guilt thing. It never felt guilty, but it eventually became about guilt for me because, now unless I seriously can't get it anywhere, like, there's nowhere to get it. I can't rent it. Netflix doesn't have it. It's not on DVD or whatever. I generally don't – well, okay. I pay for cable. I pay for a full cable suite. So, you know, if I want to see something on TV, I'll just get it on demand. I rarely download American TV shows. I only download anime when I absolutely have to. There's no other way to get it. But it became kind of a guilt thing for me because now I have friends who work as creative professionals. Now I have friends, you know, certainly in the anime industry, their lives are directly impacted by piracy. So it became kind of a thing like, oh, this is not a victimless crime. It really isn't. And that's sort of what it became about for me. It became kind of like a, well, this actually kind of does hurt people if you do it too much. If you're just constantly pirating everything you watch, if all of your entertainment consumption is piracy, it does have an impact. You know, it's not a totally victimless crime.
I can't say I've never felt guilty, but it was a whole lot less of a factor for me, mostly because for me, the choice is, you know, okay, let's say I pirated a whole, like, 90-some episode show,
mm-hmm.
And I like it, I don't love it. The choice, I never would have bought it.
Right.
So it's not like I would have really lost, you know, nobody actually lost anything, so... In my point of view, it's basically about, it's like, do I want to contribute to this? If I like the show, yeah, I'll buy it. And especially, even, you know, in my position now, like, say a show that I downloaded on Fansub gets released by Bandai. Bandai would send me the discs if I asked.
Right.
But I don't really want to ask.
Yeah.
You know, I would rather pay for it. I would rather... contribute that one unit of sales so maybe they can release something else.
Yeah, I get a lot of screeners in the mail, but they all go out to critics. So if there's something I really want, I just buy it. I could ask. I could just go to Funimation and say, hey, can you send me this box set? And they would, but I'd just rather pay for it. It's not expensive. I make a decent wage. I'm an adult, you know. I can buy things that I like.
And I think you hit the nail on the head there. We are adults, and we're making an okay living. We can afford this.
Yeah.
As someone who was previously not in that position, I can completely understand the ravenousness of not being able to afford it and it being right there.
Yeah, I think the problem comes, like, here's the thing. I've never had a problem with somebody who does something that they know isn't 100% right, but at least they just say, yeah, I know it's not right, but I can't afford this and I really want to see it. That person to me is sympathetic. The raging, angry, like, fuck you, I got mine pirates, I have no sympathy for those people. Like, they're just being dicks about it. But the people who are just straight up honest about it, like, look, I really like this show, I really want to watch it, but goddamn, I have $5 in my bank account. Okay, you know what? I mean, I was there once, you know? I can't rage against those people.
Right, or something like, you know, hey, I'm a huge Big Wind Up fan. we already were told we're not getting season two. You're damn straight I'm downloading those fan subs.
Oh, one thing I will do occasionally is if I really loved something and it's in the interim between, it's not on demand, it's not on DVD, I can't go to the theater and see it, I can't rent it, but I really want to see it again, in that case, I will download it occasionally. I really loved the show Bored to Death from last year, and it was only like 6 or 7 episodes, or 8 episodes, I think. And it got announced for season 2. It went off the air after 2 months. They put it on demand for like a month, and now you can't get it anywhere. And I really wanted to watch it again on a plane trip. I was like, man, I really want to see that show again. And I've already got the Blu-ray pre-ordered for that. So I downloaded it, and I watched it again, and I enjoyed myself. And then when my Blu-ray show up, I'll watch it again. In the interim case, sometimes when you're impatient, you know.
Yeah, I did that with the season finale of Breaking Bad, actually. I literally could not wait for it to show up on Amazon.
Yeah. Yeah,
so I downloaded it so I could watch it an hour earlier.
Yeah, and you're going to, of course, buy those Blu-rays when it comes out.
I damn straight.
Yeah. Honestly, I got to be honest with you. Like, here's one thing that I will do. When it comes to, like, movies... and I'm not going to, I think I have to stop this practice just because now they're starting to get aggressive about it. But if there's a movie that's out and it's only out in New York or Los Angeles, this happens a lot around award season. Mm-hmm. It's only out in New York or, if it's out in LA, I'll go to it here. But a lot of times stuff only opens in New York or it's playing on the festival circuit and a copy of it will show up online. If I'm really dying to see that movie, I'll find the theater that it's playing at. Buy a ticket for that on Fandango and get the movie. Obviously, I can't go to the theater in New York to see it, but I will have paid. I will have paid for the seat. You know what I'm saying?
See, that's cool. That's awesome. I totally respect that.
It wouldn't hold up in court if I ever got dragged to court for downloading the movie.
But. No, it would not. But I think. Honestly, how many? Well, okay.
I feel it's kind
of
like
they're cracking down on. But most of the time, you know, the prosecution of these things is so lax. You basically can't rely on the law for your barometer of right and wrong here.
I feel like paying for the ticket. It's like covering my carbon footprint. You know. It's
yeah. Like totally. I mean, and the same with how I do TV. I mean, I don't subscribe to cable, and I kind of resent the institution of cable. there is nothing you could do that would make me want to pay $100 a month for access to almost pure garbage. Mm. I'm quite happy with my terrestrial HD, thank you very much. But there are a number of great shows that you can only get on cable, and when they are available online on demand on iTunes, on Amazon, if I had Xbox Live, I will always pay for them. But yeah. If they're not. You know, you can't make me pay for cable, goddammit.
I enjoy cable immensely, so I feel that it's worth it, especially since I don't have to go, like, the convenience of cable, again, back to the convenience thing, I'd rather just pay for cable and not have to go through all the downloading and the, you know, the streaming and all that stuff. I'd rather just watch it on TV.
You know, that's a really good point, because when I talk to licensors and I talk to industry people about how to stop piracy, the one point I have to go to again and again is it's not always about the cost. It's about laziness.
Yeah.
You know, how many people really scour LimeWire for music these days?
LimeWire, is that still around?
Or they've been sued into oblivion a few times. But, you know, seriously, most people just pay the frickin' 99 cents and download it off iTunes.
Yeah. That's
easier, and you know you're getting a decent quality encode, not full of weird glurps and things like that.
Yeah, I don't bother pirating music anymore. What's the point? I mean, like, again, like, not even on iTunes. I'll go to Amazon because they undercut iTunes by $2 on every album. So
even better.
Everything's $8 on Amazon. That's a great deal for an album.
I seldom buy whole albums, but
yeah. Well, I mean, I buy a lot of comedy albums. That you can't just buy like one track off of a comedy album.
Yeah, that doesn't work.
So yeah, I get them on Amazon. They're $8. The artist gets his due, you know. And a lot of it for me, like, it really does boil down to the artist getting their due. Like, I've preached about this. I practice what I preach. I want to see the artist get paid. That's a job. It's a profession. You know, they're not just doing it out of love. It's a job. And so, you know, the artist deserves to get paid.
I am incredibly cheap, and so I definitely enjoy finding the cheapest, easiest way to get things for almost free, legally.
Yeah. Well, who doesn't?
Well, I mean, it's so easy now. It is so easy. I mean, all the streaming stuff is free, or, you know, free with a few commercials. Who cares, as long as it works. Mm-hmm. Netflix is, you know, unstoppable if you're into streaming.
Yeah.
And, you know, even stuff on iTunes, you know, my bank has thank you points. I can't remember the last time I paid for iTunes credit.
Yeah. The one thing I will say, though, is that in terms of piracy, there's one channel that is still following the old way of doing things, and that's AMC. They have two huge shows that are zeitgeist shows. These are huge and hugely popular now. Mad Men and Breaking Bad, as we talked about. And they don't make those available streaming anywhere. If you want to see them, you got to either have cable or buy the DVDs, and it's working for them. Like, that model still does.
That's not true.
That model still does work. You can't stream Mad Men anywhere.
I buy it on Amazon day and date.
I mean, you can't go to like Hulu and watch Amazon. You can buy it on iTunes.
It's premium content, and I'll happily pay for that.
Right, exactly. You either have cable or you pay for it, and that's it.
Right.
And I'm sure those shows are pirated by millions and millions of people.
But I'm sure.
They're hugely successful anyway.
You know, the funny thing is the stuff on Amazon is better quality, like a lot better quality.
Than what, HD cable?
Yeah.
Well, whatever.
The HD cable rips, I should say.
Yeah, well, I mean, my HD cable looks great, so I don't really care about that. But anyway, so, well, that was interesting.
I think it's nice that we basically, because we get accused of being, you know, anti-fan sub a lot.
Yeah, people just bristle at any remote, and that's, actually, this is the point that I do want to make. People bristle at even the suggestion of hypocrisy, and my attitude towards that is, look, I am not ideologically pure about this. I'm just not.
No.
I'm just not. I'm not an ideologue about it. I'm not all or nothing. It's a big gray area. It's always been that way for me, you know. I really, and again, we've talked about this a million times in the past. It's not about the fan subs themselves. It's not about that.
Yeah, you know? It's, and, you know, especially with things like One Manga, it's about something, just a problem, a behavior being so out of control that someone has to do something. And yes, it's going to break how people have the systems people have worked out for themselves as far as consuming the content, but, you know, sorry.
Yeah. Figure out another way to get it. Okay, so anyway, so we have a long, long interview coming up, so we should go ahead and get to that. Alright, we're back. Our guest this week is the head of guest industry and press relations for Otakon, Jim Voles. Hey, how's it going, man?
It's all right.
Awesome. Thanks a lot for coming on the show. I cannot imagine how busy you are right now.
Well, luckily, we made arrangements in advance, so I carefully arranged for all the emergencies to happen during every other waking hour.
What is the crunch time right before? I mean, it sounds like it starts. I mean, how many months out are you in, you know, crisis mode?
It pretty much starts before last year's con ends.
Oh, okay.
Some of our stuff we start way in advance. Some of it doesn't come together to the last minute. There's a guest we'll be announcing this week that we've known was very interested in coming since before last year's con. And it'll be made clear at time who it is. And then people who've encountered that guest before will go, ah. But yeah, there's a lot of advance work, especially for the musical guests. It takes a lot of time to get that moving.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a minute. So let's just get the promotional stuff sort of out of the way. What can people look forward to at Otakon this year?
Well, let's see. We've probably got our most diverse musical guest list ever. I always start with the musical guests because they take the longest planning. Mm-hmm. We have the Yoshida Brothers playing traditional shamisen stuff, but very modern way. On Friday night, people will probably know them from the Nintendo We Would Like to Play commercials.
Yeah.
And their stuff is pretty awesome, actually. There's a lot of, I think kind of like when we had Eminence, there's a lot of people going, really? I can't wait to see that. So that makes me happy.
Mm-hmm.
On Sunday, we will have Homemade Kazoku, who is they're kind of like a fun hip-hop, very high-energy act that they've done a couple of Bleach and Naruto themes, I think. And then we'll be announcing a special. I said from the beginning that I was not going to get locked into doing four musical acts like I have managed to do the last couple of years, because it's kind of brutal to everybody concerned.
Yeah.
It's hard on the staff. It's hard on logistics. And it always winds up being more costly than it looks like it's going to be. We'll have a special guest on Saturday who will be playing a couple of songs during the halftime at the arena. We should probably save that for later.
Halftime at the arena. What does that mean?
We do our big masquerade contest on Saturday at the arena.
Oh.
And because it's the biggest room that we can get, it seats up to 14,000 people, depending on configuration. But usually we pack it with about between 6,000 and 8,000 people for masquerade. Usually that's on Saturday nights. That's our big main event on Saturdays, which is why we've tended to have afternoon concerts on Wednesdays when we have anything, or on Saturdays when we have anything. But we got something special, and it was the time and place that it was going to make sense to do it. So we'll announce that a little bit later. And, of course, we have a couple of the usual suspects on our guest list, plus a few new ones. We have, let's see, there's, we announced Vic Mignogna, and I know, Vic Mignogna at a con? It's crazy talk, I tell
you. My God.
Wow, you could call that an exclusive.
You guys first, man, because that's where all the love goes. we have Miley Flanagan, who does the voice of Naruto. We've never had her at Otakon before, and she seems pretty cool, so I'm looking forward to that.
I've heard she's a very nice person.
Yeah, and she's pretty funny, too. I've seen some of her other stuff that she's been in. You know, I happened to catch a guest appearance of her on a show, and I thought I recognized the voice, and I was right. I forget what show it was now, but... we worked with Funimation to bring quite a few of the folks that are starring in some of their shows this year. We have Chris Bevins, Clarine Harp, Todd Haberkorn, Jerry Jewell. We do have an old school voice actors coming. We haven't had Amy Howard Wilson in a long time at Otakon, and she was one of our early supporters. And with the Yamato movie coming out, we're hopeful that she'll be getting some work again soon, but you know, that remains to be seen. We have a fashion designer coming to do a full-fledged fashion show. On Saturday morning, we'll be doing that. That's H. Naoto. He designs for a lot of rock stars and got a lot of excitement and buzz on the Twitterverse when we announced that one, which I wasn't expecting, honestly. I wasn't sure how that was going to work out, but I think the more oddball guests from a, you know, the less standard guests seem to get an interesting reception with us. And then we have Mr. Sakurai, who's... he's like one of those guys that seems to be doing all sorts of things in pop culture. He writes for papers and he puts together books and produces things. And he's done a couple of other kinds. I think he did KawaiiCon not too long ago, but he's going to come in and give almost an academic sort of a talk, but talking about the Harajuku culture and all that other stuff.
In Japanese or English?
I believe he's doing it in English. I'm still waiting on some of the details for that. That's actually one of those occasions where the guest kind of contacts us and says, hey, I'd like to come and I'm going to be there. So he's kind of a pop culture ambassador right now. So, you know, we're happy to have him. I believe it was our Sony connections that he had talked to. And I think with having something other than just the usual rock bands kind of caught their attention this year, which is nice.
Nice change of pace.
Cool. Yeah, we tried to get the guy that did the Rakugo back this year, but he wasn't available. He wants to come back, though. We were his biggest performance he's ever done.
I imagine that's probably true for many of your guests, just with the sheer amount of people.
Well, you'd think that, but, you know, we have guests that have played the Tokyo Dome, so there's all sorts of extremes there. It's just that I think that the storytelling stuff tends to be, you know, the size of a decent sized bar or a small studio in Japan. So,
right.
Suddenly being confronted with a packed house of, you know, 680 was kind of a surprise. I mean, we had no idea when I went upstairs and the line was out the door and they were turning people away. I was like, really? Awesome. You know?
Also, Rakugo is very much for old people in Japan. So performing Rakugo for a bunch of screaming white teenagers had to be a very surreal experience for them.
It was funny because I missed the entire performance because I was busy dealing with other things. And right across the hall was when we had the Kano sisters. And the Rakugo performer's wife was there, and she was so excited because the Kano sister was going to be there. When he walked out, I said, "So how did it go?" And he said, "Oh, it went very well. It was a very enthusiastic crowd. I wish I could have done more."
Meanwhile, across the hall, Kano sister's ghost town.
I said I missed it because I was busy trying to get the Kano sister stuff off and making sure that that went off well. But you know, I'm hopeful to look at the archive later. And he goes, "The Kano sisters are here, honey." And he went and got his wife, and they ran across to see him. It was funny.
Marking the first time anyone's run to see the Kano sisters.
Just kidding. No, okay. That was such a weird thing, but it ended up working out pretty well for us. I had no regrets at all. They were fine to deal with, and it made Pony Canyon happy, and you know that sets up future opportunities and got press in Japan, which is always nice for us as well.
Cool. Any film premieres, anything like that?
We got a couple things coming from, I think, Funimation will have a couple of premieres with us. Bandai will have probably at least one or two. And I'm being a little cagey with those because they're not completely confirmed yet. Some of them, it's going to depend on whether they've got the dub done in time or whether they've got the official print released in time.
Okay, so you mentioned that you were a little... you were surprised that so many people responded to having this fashion designer come. Now, I have to imagine in 2010, it's got to be getting pretty difficult to figure out original, unique programming for an anime convention.
It's actually one of our higher priorities. We have a lot of deep, dark, caffeine-fueled discussions at our staff meetings about how to keep doing something new and different. I mean, we try to believe that the sort of unofficial motto is not just talk. You know, it's the con got started with people saying, "Well, that con sucked. We can do better than that." And we've kind of kept to that ever since. So every year we figure out what we didn't like about how things went and try to top it. And of course, you know, that's always the challenge. When we got started, even when I started with the con, there were a handful of anime themed cons, and now there's like two a week, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
It's a little ridiculous, but yeah, I mean, the thing is that with Otakon, our cultural mission is at the heart of what we do. So we keep a lot of stuff in there because it makes the fans happy, and we keep a lot of stuff in there because we're all geeks and we all enjoy the same sort of crazy stuff. But we've always tried to put actual meat in the programming, and whether that's getting, you know, how to wear a kimono properly from someone who actually knows how to do it panels, or whether that's, you know, we've done tea ceremony. I think we did a sushi making thing at one point, and origami and crafts and stuff like that are easy for people to kind of get a handle on. But, you know, we've tried to encourage some of the, there have been some very good fan panels where they kind of explain the cultural references, and just anecdotally, I know a lot of people tell me that they got interested in the culture by watching the stuff on TV. And I was like, well, you've just described our mission right there. You know, you watch the stuff on TV and then you go look up, well, what is that tea ceremony all about? Or what really is the Bushido code? And it kind of all spins off from there. So, you know, we keep trying to get more and more programming of that sort. We've been working with the Japanese embassy down in DC, for some of that. We work with them year round on some other stuff, and of course we do the Cherry Blossom Festival with them. So they were the ones that helped us get the Rakugo performer a couple years ago, and they've tried to help us get some other stuff, but we keep running into timing issues, I think.
Right. Now it seems to me that in the last, like, I don't know if my timing is right here, but Musical X have really become the headline events at most of the major conventions in the last, like, 5 years. And you guys kind of started out with the biggest one.
We actually had a couple of, I mean, everybody thinks of Lark on Seal as the big one that we've ever had.
Do you eat crap?
Yeah.
Well, sorry.
Yeah.
Kind of was, though.
Did you notice we got a reference to that into the opening animation a couple years ago?
I didn't see it.
Sure. Yeah, I remember that. No, I'm sorry. I did not see those opening animations.
Oh, that's right. You haven't seen them. That's because you never come to visit us.
That's because your convention is a freaking week before San Diego. Move it back to August, my friend. Please.
We are unfortunately not at liberty to move very far because we usually aim for the first week of August, but the convention center had bookings out, you know, 10 years in advance when we started working there. So, and unfortunately, the other nearby ones are just not a good fit for us.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about the convention center in a little bit, but you were talking about musical acts.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we had BOA early on. That's the British band BOA that did the music for Lane. Obviously, we had TMR in 2003. That's the first one I really remember because I wound up in the video that he posted on the web, which is very strange. Hmm. We had Yoko Kanno and Mari Ijima, I think in 2001, I want to say, or 2000. I get the years wrong sometimes for the ones that were before I was on staff. And we had the Parapara folks were there. So we'd had, three or four years of musical acts before we had gotten to Lark on Seal. Okay. But Lark on Seal was such a big get and such a huge thing. And it was one of those perfect storm moments where it was an act that was getting back together and they were going to do a big tour and they wanted to do something really splashy. And they were going to be headlining a big deal anime that was going to be getting a huge push. And Sony was launching Tofu Records. So everybody had marketing money at the same time. Hmm. And that was back when people actually bought products. So it was some hope of getting some return there. But it was hideously expensive. I mean, it was internally, it was a huge fight as to whether we were going to do it or not. People were worried that it was straying too far from the mission. People were worried that it was just going to be incredibly expensive and a money sink and was going to bankrupt the con. I mean, this was probably one of the hottest debated things that I can remember.
Was it worth it in the end?
I think it was, yeah. I mean, for a ton of reasons. First of all, the publicity to this day has still stayed with us.
You guys have had, you had lines around, what, 5 city blocks for that?
Yeah, but you have to remember too that they're not big sidewalks there, so the actual lining space is fairly narrow. So it's slightly less impressive than say if you had a 5 city block line by the Nokia Center where you have cavernously large sidewalk space and lots of lining areas.
It's LA. We don't even have regular city blocks.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't going to diss somebody else's city, even though they seem to have no trouble dissing mine.
Well, it's Baltimore.
Yeah.
You guys have one of the best TV shows in history showing you guys your best light possible.
Yeah. Laugh it up, guys. Laugh it up.
But in all honesty, like, and you know, we don't want to come across as biased or anything, but the mood at Otakon is still probably the last big show that really feels like it is truly the by fans for fans thing. God bless them over at the SPJA. They run a very professional show. Not that you guys don't run a professional show, but AX has always felt, a bit more like a real like trade show. Like this is where business happens. In addition to being a fan convention, but Otakon has always had that real fan spirit. And I'm curious how you guys have managed to maintain that over the years.
We fight a lot.
I think we have a question about that.
No, seriously, SPGA, and I'll say this because, as you guys know, I have friends over there, and yep, they have friends over here, and we get along a lot better in person than people think we do. Mm-hmm. But, if you look them up, they are a trade organization. Their job is to promote the trade.
Yeah.
And our job is to promote the culture and the understanding of the culture using pop culture as a gateway. So, officially we are an educational nonprofit and they're a trade promotion nonprofit. So there's that underlying thing that kind of underscores all the decisions that we make. But the structural stuff that we have in place, the term limits on leadership, the unpaid nature of all of our staffers. I mean, we're all not paid for this work. And it's a very different set of decisions that you make, I think, when it's your job and your livelihood depends on it, than when you basically don't have to really think too much beyond 1 year in terms of making decisions. And that has pluses and it has minuses. We do lose some folks through attrition that, gosh, if only we had a couple of extra 10 grand to throw around here and there to actually compensate people for their time, would be, you know, might make the difference and make people burn out less or make it more attractive to step up to some of the bigger roles. But on the flip side of that, you know, it's not like most of the people at Expo get paid. It's the people that run that part of it that, and I don't want to make a whole big deal about the whole getting paid thing, but it has been one of the things that some cons do and some cons don't. And we don't do it specifically so that we won't make decisions based on money. Right. Does that make sense?
It does. At the same time, like we've dealt with that at ANN. Like every single person, ANN has this sort of ragtag reputation for being. You know, it started out as a very fan run organization. Now it's very much we're a professional organization. Everybody that works for us is paid. Right. We don't allow people to write for us for free just because we need to have control over the employees. You can't control a staff. Really, that's not being compensated for their work. So I can imagine that must be a real struggle for you guys.
It is. I mean, but it's a struggle that every volunteer organization faces to some extent or another. I mean, I've had family that have worked for hospitals in you know, the candy stripers and stuff, and from that to soup kitchens to anything that's like that, you will always run into issues where, you know, somebody somewhere in the staff has got to make a hard decision. Do I spend 20 hours a week doing Otakon, or do I spend 20 hours a week doing, you know, working at McDonald's and pulling in some extra cash? And we lose a lot of good people to the real life, I have to make a living problem, you know?
Well, it's a huge time commitment, right?
Yeah, it's a huge – it depends on the role. I mean, there's a couple – there's probably – I would say maybe half a dozen people that are really engaged fully year round. I'm one of them, the con chair and the president, whether they're one person or the same, or two people. The guys that work exhibitions, who also do our table at other conventions, are pretty much in it year round. Those tend to be the people whose role requires them to be more engaged all the time. And then it gets really crazy. You know, we've run into the thing where we're trying to document how many hours people are putting in when they're working just at the con. And it gets very crazy very quickly, especially for, you know, guests, cause you're always on.
Yeah. You know, exactly.
Trying to justify, oh, you only worked 20 hours today, you know?
Well, so what drives you to do it? What's your personal motivation?
Well, I got started doing it because I wanted to go to the con, and I was extremely underpaid where I was at the time, and volunteering at the con was a way to comp my badge. And then on our staff, you have to be recommended by two staffers. So when I finally got to bump up to staff, I was all enthusiastic, and you know, I was an older staffer, but I was a new staffer. So I still had that initial enthusiasm, and wound up working a bunch of different projects and got summoned to guests. And I like working with guests, you know. It's kind of fun to have cool people that you know that will take your calls. And that's, you know, that's part of the fun of it. The last couple of years, it's largely because when you've invested 10 years of your life into something, you want to make sure that it gets handed off well. And one of the things we've tried to focus on the last year or so internally is making sure that people have backup. So if I get hit by a bus, all the contacts don't go with me, and all the effort isn't wasted.
Right. Yeah, that's kind of interesting because your actual career, I mean, you're an IT guy, right?
Yeah.
You basically have two careers now. You have
your
IT job, and then you have also have this 10-year career in press relations, basically, which is a tough skill to learn. That's a whole different skill set.
Yeah, it's weird because when I started working for the con, I'd already done some work planning conferences for a previous job, and so it wasn't entirely new to me. There were scientific conferences, but you know, it's still wrangling guests and getting people in and making all the logistics happen. So I kind of had that going at the beginning, and I've always One of my friends teases me because my whole family seems to have this weird skill of winding up, you know, at the bar with the guest at the sci-fi con. You know, it's just one of those crazy things. So it just worked out that way. And it worked out that I was old enough to rent a car, and that's how I wound up in guests.
right.
Which is where I wanted to be anyway, so.
Right, interesting.
Going back to the convention center. Now, there's always been a thing about Otakon basically being too big for the – they basically outgrown the Baltimore Convention Center, and you had to institute an attendance cap. What can you tell us about that whole situation?
Sometime around 2004, I believe the fire marshal took a look at the crowded hallways and the congestion and said, you guys need to do something about this for next year. And in fall of 2004, we had a big staff retreat where we tackled a bunch of issues related to our growth and planned for them. And there were some stellar arguments at that one, too, because, you know, it's wrangling cats. So we did some layout changes designed to alleviate some of the problem. But to be on the safe side, because they will never give you a solid number. They will never give you a maximum. They will tell you, here's your danger points, and you have to kind of adjust. So we set an attendance cap in 2005 and kept it in 2006 as we continued to adjust for things. And then in 2007, we released the attendance cap because by that point we were planning to use the arena, which gets about 7,000 people out, and that gets them out of there during our crunch time, which is basically Saturday night when everybody's at the con.
Right.
So getting that much out of the building acts as a pretty big relief valve there.
They so just added
attendance cap.
They just added a whole other hotel, right? So are you expanding into that now?
Well, yeah, actually it was weird because I ended up getting roped into that. They did an interview. One of the TV stations did an interview with me that got a lot of airtime because there was a big internal fight within the city about whether to invest in this new convention center hotel, which is the new Hilton. And we kind of got dragged in the middle of it because we're the biggest event that uses that hotel or that convention center all year. We're the second biggest event in Baltimore. Yeah, we were held up as this is the business that Baltimore will lose if they don't invest in the infrastructure of this space. And what they basically did was they built a nice big convention center hotel right next to the convention center, which added a couple of ballrooms and a bunch of meeting space. We used some of it last year for panels, and the rest of it we're actually taking over the whole thing this year. So we'll be using some of the rooms for like press meeting rooms, and we'll be using I think at least one of the ballrooms, possibly both of them. I don't remember right now because I'm not using them for my stuff, so unfortunately I forgot.
So what but is yeah. the biggest event in Baltimore if it's not you guys?
There's a citywide event called Artscape, which is the biggest art festival I think on the East Coast. It's one of the biggest in the country. And it basically they shut down most of the downtown area. There's been one or two years where they've either been the weekend before us or the weekend after us, and one year they were the weekend of us. Which was,
God.
I'm sure it was no fun. Although I would point out to people that the year that I was con chair for Otakon, we had the Yankees in town all 3 days.
I remember that.
Yeah. There were some incidents.
Not that I'm bitter. They used up my hotel space. They were rude to my people. And
yep, I remember that. I was there for that.
That was also the year it was 107 degrees on Thursday, and I had 30 people faint.
Man.
I was there. It seems like every year that air conditioning is just like barely holding on for dear life.
It was probably one of the hottest. I think we've had one since then that was a little hotter, but I think it was hot one day in 2009. But I always give Sean Shoshank Hittman, who's con chair this year, I give him a lot of grief because he was my vice chair. And after putting up with all the heat and stuff my year, we had like perfect weather his year. No conflicts, perfect weather. I was like, yeah, that's just so not fair.
So how do you think – now, obviously, Anime Fandom has changed dramatically in the last 10 years. How do you think, you know, sort of in brief, what's the biggest change that you've seen? And do you think things are getting better or getting worse?
Way to ask a loaded question there. I think a couple of things have changed. Yeah, it's not like it's your job or anything to ask a prodding question. They've gotten younger. I've gotten older. So that part was inevitable. But I think there's plenty of demographic evidence to prove that they've gotten younger. When I first started doing this, it was mostly college kids and post-grads and some high schoolers. And we've always kind of been an all-ages con, but the number of people in their early teens has grown by leaps and bounds. So that's, you know, there's a slide that way, and with that comes some immaturity, but it also doesn't necessarily, you know, there's not necessarily a one-to-one correspondence there. But I think also, you know, and this is me talking and not speaking on behalf of Otakon, but I think that part of the thing that's happened is that anime has become so much easier to get that the fundamental reason that people come to a con like Otakon has shifted. And it's always been a social beast, but it used to be where you'd see the new thing from Japan that you hadn't been able to get through the tape traders yet. And now it's the place that you go to see the new thing from Japan with the guy that was in it or something. You know, it's become a lot more like some of the media cons where there's celebrities and, you know, your comment about Vic earlier, Vic's one of the guys that goes to a lot of cons and he has a big fan base and, you know, there's become a lot more of that and a lot less of the, how do you speak Japanese? What did you do to translate that stuff? Although there is still a strong audience for that. I don't know that that's grown by as much as the people who want to fangirl out over the sexy musical guest, you know?
Right.
So I think that has changed as fandom has changed. And the social aspects have evolved as the internet has become a more unavoidable factor in everyday life.
I like that word. Yeah.
Well, I make my living building web pages for people. So it's like, I'm not really complaining about the internet, but it does change how people are used to interacting. And so instead of having the focus be on big communal, hey, we all saw the premiere of this movie, it's, you know, there are people who come to the con and all they do is hang out in the hallway with their friends and cosplay and share internet memes. And, you know, if that's your thing, more power to you. And thanks for making it possible for us to get better guests and treat them better and make sure that the sound systems are nice because you're paying for that. But I wish more of them would get involved in actually, you know, going to the con for what it's about. But I think that as that has changed, you know, we've had wars and economies shift and the whole Japan became cool, then it became uncool, then it became cool again, and now it's differently cool than it was. And, you know,
yeah,
I don't think it ever stops changing. I've been involved in sci-fi fandom for a long time, and I don't think those things ever change. You'll still have your core nerd, hardcore, you know, everything must be the way it was fans. And then you will have the people who are much more casual about it, but decide to go to these things because they like to hang out with their friends. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
Have you had any incidents where the internet stuff just got too far out of hand? You guys sort of had an infamous run-in with 4chan a couple of years ago.
Yeah, the thing with 4chan always bugs me because Moot is not a bad guy.
No.
But Moot has created a monster that he cannot control.
Right.
And we gave them, I think, one chance too many. And the people who are basically internet anarchists and do not understand that real life and the internet are not the same thing. You know, without going too far down this path, the greater internet fuckwad theory applies.
Right.
And when people try to take that same behavior to real life, it's going to have consequences. And I can't go into too many details, but it got ugly, and it got ugly enough that they were basically told they're not welcome back again. And Moot did a cartoon about it and put it up, and it was basically him being sad, saying, "This is why we can't have nice things."
Right. Yeah. No, I remember that. But
it's a shame because so many good things can come of that. But you know, 4chan was in the news this weekend because they put some nasty Justin Bieber search to the top of Google's list. You know, I'm sorry, guys. Find something else to do with your lives, please.
I got to admit, I think that's funny.
It's funny. It's funny the first time. It's not funny the 10th time.
Or six
it's not funny
later.
When that's what people do 24 hours a day. And I've talked to people who that is all that they live for. And, you know.
What a life.
Really?
Yeah, I mean it's kind of sad, but maybe my perception on this is wrong, or maybe I haven't been to Otakon in 3 years because of Comic-Con, but it seems to me like the internet stuff, it kind of peaked a few years ago in terms of just being just ridiculously over the top, where you're like invading other people's personal space and just going too far with it. Either you guys have curbed that, or maybe it's gotten a little bit less, toned down a little bit.
I think what happened is we clamped down hard. I mean we. After 2 years of people coming to the, you know, at the end of every con, we have the big come and complain about the con to us, and we'll tell you we'll try to fix it. That most cons do, and we write everything down, and then we argue about that amongst ourselves later. But for 2 years, we struggled with how we could deal with all the signs, because it wasn't just people holding up a free hug sign. It was people with signs having sign battles. It was people with signs that were just downright rude or just way too suggestive.
And, my personal favorite was the giant pedo bear.
Well, yeah. Well, the thing about the pedo bear is that there's nothing inherently wrong with the pedo bear. It's what you do with the pedo bear.
We're going to quote you on that one. That's a quote right there.
Yeah, I think we need to have like a nice framed gif of that.
Oh, God. Half an hour in and I've already stuck my foot in it. All right. But, I mean, we basically... And for some reason, I wind up frequently being the person that has to write at least the first cut of these things. But we wrote up a sign policy and we enforced it. And a lot of other people had had them and hadn't enforced them, or they'd sort of haphazardly enforced them. But we stuck to our guns about it, and the sign thing died down.
Right.
Thank God for that. Those signs are really annoying.
And we've got one guy that shows up every year wearing an obnoxious T-shirt that. We say, you know what, this violates our sign policy. It's a sign that's on your shirt, but you're being ridiculous about it. And he wants to argue free speech. I'm like,
this is technically a private event.
here's our lawyer who will explain to you for the third year running how this is not your issue to fight here.
My God.
It's a public building when we're not renting it. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Actually, the signs seem quaint to me now, because the last time I was at New York Anime Festival, and I mean, I've always been of the mind that West Coast conventions are a little bit less wild than East Coast. I mean, I think maybe it's just a fandom thing, but
it's another thing.
Yeah. Yeah. But the thing that I noticed at New York Anime Fest were they started these shout battles.
Oh my God. That was horrible.
We've been hearing about that all year, and I caught part of one of those up at New York Anime Fest. So I know wherever you speak.
Yeah, that seems to be like the worst thing to have come about lately.
I think that's, again, people who are used to interacting primarily online don't understand that that's inappropriate. And, you know, we are the same con that has kicked out dealers for selling bootlegs, and we are the same con that has kicked out people for being too stinky or threatened to.
Thank you, by the way. Sorry.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I put myself on the line for that one because I'd had enough. And I said, I would be the sniff test. And if I think you're stinky, I will kick your ass out. And people understood that I was going to do it. Helped that I was con chair, but.
Right.
But I think I still am the designated sniff tester. So if something is particularly stinky, they will have to deal with me. And then I'll have been pulled away from something more important and be angry about it. So
what a pleasant job. So it sounds like you actually wind up doing a lot of this enforcement yourself. Like, are you the guy that sort of takes point? No.
Part of the reason why I get pulled into these things is because I've been on the board for, I think, 5 or 6 of the last 6 or 7 years. And that's a yearly elected thing as well. I always have to think. But there's a term limit to that, too. And I wasn't on the board in 2009. So, you know, I can't really speak to what went on that year. But for most of the other years, the board is made up of people who have been or are currently active in running the con. And it's usually a decent mix of people, but it tends to be a lot of the same people because they're the people willing to dedicate the time and spend the effort. So,
yeah,
you know, and I write, so I get to write stuff a lot.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, on a more positive note, what positive changes have you noticed? What do you think's gotten better?
About cons in general or about Otakon?
Either or.
I think in general, the thing I'm happiest about is that cons still retain the there's a freaky magic power that fandom can have when it's done well. And it's that, you know, this is a big house with lots of room in it. And it can be very welcoming and very supportive and very loyal to its own. And it can be very admirable in those ways. It can also be very infighty and family-ish. But the best compliment I get from guests is when they ask what they have to do to be invited back again because they had such a good time. And the best compliment I get from the members is when I see them talking about this is the thing they look forward to every year. It's the thing that they will drop other plans for. And it's not just because they want to come see a cool band or they want to go get an autograph from some awesome guy or they want to participate in the LARP or the masquerade or whatever. It's that they can come there and be them or a particular version of them and not catch crap for it, which is why I was in a virtual rage when I found out about the incidents with the Yankees fans. But to our con goers' credit, they basically replied back, "That's a goofy costume you're wearing too." Mm-hmm. But you know, I like the fact that we're safe. You can leave your kids at the con and they're going to be fine. And we may have a rave for two nights, but it's not a nasty, stinky place. Well, it gets a little stinky.
I was about to say.
You get a lot of people dancing for that long. You know, it takes a little while to air out.
Yeah.
But and some people will insist on dancing in full length PVC gear. I don't understand that at all. But I'm going to be 40, so you know, what the hell do I know about what the kids like?
Right.
Well, now you've been doing this so long. What are some of the events that used to be really popular but have just kind of faded into obscurity? I'm always curious about this.
The big one is Mystery Anime Theater 3000, which I almost got them to come back in 2006. Almost. I deployed everything I could think of, a nice combination of sucking up and trying to find ways to make it easier for them to do it. The problem is that it's insanely time consuming. And the cast for that one, who are all just, you know, they're all very funny guys. They're great, nerdy guys to have a conversation with. And they're all active in various ways on staff. But it takes forever, and you have to watch a bad anime over and over again to come up with good jokes. And then you have to practice them, and then you have to perform. So it wound up eating just endless amounts of their time. And they felt like they had done it well enough that they wanted to leave on a high note and not just be doing it because they didn't want the event to die. You know, better to be the awesome show that you know, it's better to be Firefly than it is to be, you know, the ninth year of Stargate. You know?
Wow. If anyone ever doubted your nerdiness, you just ended that right now.
I don't think that's ever been in doubt by anyone who's talked to me at the time.
Okay. Well, Justin, you have anything, or should we move on to Twitter?
Let's go on to Twitter.
Okay.
Oh, God.
Well, just before we get to this, though, obviously, if you want to give the formal plug for the dates and where people can go to find out more.
You can find out about Otakon at www.otakon.com. That was too radio voice.
I'll keep it.
Our dates this year are 30 July to 1 August. So the last weekend of July. And it's in Baltimore at the Baltimore Convention Center, the Hilton Convention Center Hotel, and the First Mariner Arena for various events. The hotels for the con are all the hotels in the city of Baltimore and some outside of it because we ate them. That was eight, not hate. And there are actually some rooms left here and there. They're not going to be close-in rooms. Not at this point. We actually killed the first couple of hotels within a week of announcing the dates. Registration is $75 in advance for the weekend. It's a membership, so it's one fee. And it's $85 at the door. And I think that's it. Wait, did I say $85 at the door?
I'm
saying it wrong. It's $65 in advance and $75 at the door. Sorry, I was just looking at another con's website.
Wow, what a deal.
I just saved everybody $10.
Okay.
Also, we extended the early bird, the pre-reg discount until July 3rd, I think.
Oh, okay. So people still have time.
Yep. Okay. Mostly because we figured out we could go a little later with it and be okay.
Okay, so first, some questions from our Anime News Network community forums, which any of you listeners out there can be part of for the low, low price of $3 a month. From Little Green Wolf, what is the scariest cross-dressing cosplayer you've ever had the influence, the misfortune to come across at a convention?
I think. Oh, I can do the obvious one here. Yeah. I met Manfei when I was at Anime Expo the first time I went out there, and had a pleasant conversation with him because he was stuck outside because he wasn't allowed in that year. And he seemed like a nice guy who got stuck with he did it once in a lark and then kind of got stuck with that personality. But it was only scary because he needed to lose a little bit of weight, which he then did by the next time I saw him.
Right. Honestly, if you are immune to the sight of hairy man but cheeks, he's not that offensive a guy.
You know what? No, he's fine. The scariest one I think I ever saw was my first year at Otakon, and it would be a toss up between one of the members of Ipponengi Bang's entourage, who was wearing a gold lame outfit, and I think it was a guy, and the scary older sailor skanky guy that was there. And I don't remember who that was, and I've seen him occasionally over the years, and he just gets older and more scrawny, and the outfit is the same size. So,
oh.
Yeah, it's a little bit sad. The creepiest one has got to be the people that do the full body with the big fake doll face thing. Something that gets in that uncanny valley for me and just freaks me out.
Yeah, like, that's the kind of thing where I feel like I'm going to, like, wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and it's going to be staring at me through my bedroom window.
Exactly. And you don't know who or what is underneath it there. And it has it has a girl face, but frequently it is not.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Yikes. I don't think I've ever seen one of those in person. Not at AX, anyway.
They had one at New York Comic Con a couple years ago, and I think we've had one at Otakon before, too, actually.
Yeah, I don't know. After so many years, none of that stuff phases me anymore.
Except for that thing. I don't find any of it that scary, to be honest with you. I mean, I did theater in high school and college, and I've been to New Orleans. So really,
right? You've seen every possible freak flag flying.
When you've walked in between a shouting match between a 60-year-old transvestite in a very bad outfit and a missionary in also a very bad outfit. Really, your bar gets lowered.
Yeah.
Oh, that reminds me. I have to ask, because, and if I don't ask this on Ancast, I'll regret it for the rest of my life. Years ago, and maybe they still happen, I heard horror stories about infamous sexual activity that would be happening on premises occasionally that would have to be basically stopped with a fire hose.
Most of those are way exaggerated. Way exaggerated. I've heard we actually had to investigate at least one or two incidents that were alleged, you know, people having sex in the rooms and, you know, in the rooms where anime was showing and stuff. I'm sorry, guys. That's bull. It didn't happen. It just didn't happen.
What? A bunch of awkward nerds.
We've had some people that were getting hot and heavy and, you know, inappropriate dancing, perhaps on occasion. Usually you shine a flashlight at them and they go away. I don't think we've ever had to actually hose people down. We've had to ask people to leave before, but it was mostly because they were just getting stupid. No breaking up, no fire hose, no in flagrante demento or whatever the hell that is.
No grotesque furry blood and chunks of fur everywhere.
What? You seem to be going right to the fur on this one, Justin.
I've heard specific stories.
I've heard specific stories, too. Everyone that we've ever investigated has proved to be bull.
Oh,
I know. It's kind of depressing, really, because, you know, I've run into stuff at high school before that was scarier than some of the stuff I've seen at Otakon. I mean, people will go hide in the bathrooms and stuff like that, and every now and again you catch them and you kick them out, but I haven't seen anybody actually – I have yet to hear about any actual sexual activity at the con.
Well, I think most of the stories we've heard happen in the hotels, not at the show itself, but in the hotels after hours.
The hotels,
thankfully, outside of Jim's jurisdiction.
My problem, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, also from Little Green Wolf, very briefly, she would like to know where the yaoi paddles come from.
Warp Little Minds.
Yes.
The yaoi paddles, I don't know. They came from a particular vendor who got the bright idea to start selling them.
Yeah, everybody knows who that guy is, the yelling guy.
Yeah, and you know what? He's making a dime on his idea, and I can't really blame him. They're technically not allowed at Otakon anymore because they're signs.
Really? Wow.
their signs, and their signs that are, they violate our sign policy and our weapon policy. So because people invariably see a thing that is meant for spanking people, and then they go around and spank people, but they unfortunately don't always remember to ask first.
Yeah, I've seen some really, like, okay, kid, like, you're going way too far with this. You're just, like, walking up to somebody with a big wooden a stranger, and just smacking them really hard, and it's like, dude, it's going to leave a mark, you know? It's not funny.
not just that, but it's assault.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Hello, this is not the internet. You cannot act like that in real life and get away with it.
I wonder, I have to wonder if Otakon does sort of provide a social community service on some level. Like, they do, like, some of these kids are learning lessons about, oh, I guess I can't behave this way in public.
I think all these sci-fi con-derived expressions of fandom, to some extent, are halfway houses for people that don't really have social skills.
Yeah.
and I say that as a guy who started his college D&D club, okay? So, you know, I love those guys. A lot of them need some help getting to the point where they can interact with normal people. And some of them need more help than others.
Right, yeah.
But the people with the yaoi petals are almost always people who you would think should know better. Usually they're little girls.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't think they should know better. In fact, those are the ones I fear most. Have you seen them at like a teeny bopper concert or something? Those girls are scary.
Well, you have heard, I think I've told you guys the story before of Terry Chu, our con chair in 2004, who was nearly trampled to death by screaming Japanese fangirls for Lark on Seal.
Yikes.
Can't say I'm shocked.
He said that was the way he wanted to go if he had to go, but but really it was actually kind of scary for a minute there. So yeah. Jesus.
Okay, from Psycho 101, he would love to know one of your most creepy, weird, or outrageous experiences during Otakon. He basically wants a funny story.
Okay, let's see. I got a funny member story. I got called in, I think I was either chair or vice chair that year, and someone had been pulled aside by our spec ops people, who are the line wranglers, and they're not security. They are, however, the people that keep people from doing stupid things. So they escorted the young gentleman, who, to my surprise, was neither drunk nor high, just young and with very poor judgment, who had run up the side of the wall to do a backflip and put his foot through the wall. And when asked why he thought it would be a good idea to run up a wall, he said that the other couple of times he had done it, his foot hadn't gone through the wall, so he figured it was okay. So Captain Backflip got a nice meeting with the facility people, who explained to him how much it was going to cost him at union labor rates to fix that wall.
Oh, man.
And then his dad was explained to how much it was going to cost his dad at union labor rates to fix that wall. And, you know, the kid was mortified. I mean, he was just dumb. But Captain Backflip is one of our fondly told stories. Let's see. What kind of fun guest story can I tell? Let's see. There's Mr. Mariyama, that comes frequently, is Mr. Mariyama is the head of Madhouse, and he's one of our more frequent guests. He's almost like our fun uncle. We actually gave him a staff T-shirt officially last year and told him he was on staff now. And I told him that was because that way I wouldn't have to pay for his flights anymore. but he met my mom, because my mom runs our green room, and said some nice things about me in halting, you know, half English and half making his interpreter translate for him. And then proceeded to poke fun at me because I had put on a bit of weight since he had seen me last. So now half the time when I see him, he headbutts me, which I'm like 9 feet tall and Mariam is like a hobbit sized. So he's at exactly the right angle to just headbutt me right in the gut.
Yeah, I was going to say, what, does he run up the wall?
No, he doesn't need to do that. He probably could, though. I don't know if you've ever seen him go zooming through the convention centers. He's a pretty speedy guy.
Yeah, he whistles like Mario when you're holding B.
Yeah. That's pretty good.
Also from Psycho 101, what's the coolest bit of swag you've ever gotten from the con, you know, from a guest or a gift or anything like that?
Honestly, it's hard to top. I mean, frequently the musical guests will frequently give me a signed CD or something like that. One year, one of the guests found out my mom played guitar, so they gave her a guitar pick with their logo on it and stuff, and she thought that was sweet. The coolest thing I think I've ever actually wound up, most of the swag I get actually winds up being recycled for prizes. In fact, I got to do that soon. Oh, there's an announcement for you. I'll probably be putting up a Jim Raid Says Closet for cool swag and gives it to randomly chosen pre-registrants for the con thing. Although I'll probably come up with a shorter name. But I don't think you can beat being put in an animation by Madhouse. That was kind of the coolest bit of swag I'll ever have.
Right. That's cool. All right. So now we're on to Twitter, and you got considerably saltier questions.
I'm sure.
On Twitter. Okay. From Botoggle. Here is a loaded one for you. So is there anything for anime fans rather than anime con fans to do at Otakon other than drink with their friends?
I don't know. With six or seven video programming rooms, four panel rooms, two workshop rooms, LARP, there's dance. Well, that's not for anime fans, I guess. Although there seem to be quite a number of them there. I think you could probably find something to do if you were inclined to. I mean, you make the con that you decide to have. You know, I've been to some really crappy cons and had a blast anyway because you make a con that you want to have. And I've been to some really great cons that I had a lousy time because I was with people that didn't really want to get involved. There'll be lots of anime. It's never going to be as new as the stuff that whoever just ripped off of their, that they just downloaded off the interwebs 5 minutes after it aired. But there's always, we have the classics room. There's always stuff that you haven't seen before to discover. So if you can't find something to do and you're an anime fan, you can't find any of the guests that interest you, even though we always have, some production side people and some talent side people involved. There's the industry panels. I have no sympathy for somebody who says that they're bored at Otakon, really.
Yeah, if you're an anime fan and you go to Otakon and you don't go to Mike Tools, Dubs at Time Forgot, turn in your card. You're done.
I never get to make it to these panels, but no. Okay. I think you can find something there. I think that question, though, is a reaction to the evolving nature of general anime cons.
Yeah, he's being snarky.
Yeah, he's being snarky. That's what Twitter's for.
Yeah, right.
I will say this. When you're an older fan and the kids are screaming the internet memes, you do feel a little out of place sometimes. Sometimes you do get the feeling like, wow, I feel like the alone adult at Chuck E. Cheese.
Yeah. Well, you're saying that to somebody who took a friend of his to Chuck E. Cheese for his 40th birthday sometime back, which I'm really dreading the payback for that.
That's more of an act of revenge. Yeah.
You know what? For all the people who complain that, oh, it's all about the voice actors and oh, it's all about the dance things, those panels are always full. And the same people are out in the hallways complaining about there's nothing to do. And we'll have, we have the guy that programs, Mr. Sua from Yamiuri TV. He programs the Monday Night Anime block that's got Detective Conan and Inuyasha and Blackjack and stuff in. And those are all, Conan and Blackjack have been around for a million years, and they're always new. We've had the directors of Lupin and Conan and stuff like that there, and their panels are, in my opinion, underattended, and it's kind of insulting. But, the same people that will complain about that will complain that you didn't get the director of the one show that they actually care about. So not that the guy that was Twittering was complaining about that. It's just kind of a general rant about people not being satisfied with whatever's there.
Okay, from Severance to Gerald from Anime World Order. Otakon's in about 6 weeks, and there's no notification as to what panels have been accepted. What's the holdup?
I am going to be talking with our programming people in the next 24 hours. One of the holdups is that there was a possibility I was going to have a lot more guests than we had originally planned for, or a lot less guests than we'd originally planned for. So the trick is that panels get assigned first to guests because we're paying to bring them out there and we have to get our money's worth. And there's plenty of panel space at Otakon, but the first 200 panels, once you get beyond a certain number, you don't know how many panels you're going to have. So I think what will probably happen is fairly early, probably by the end of the week at the very latest, there'll be a drop from the panels folks about which panels have been accepted. And then they'll start plugging them in. But we're supposed to meet to build a schedule this week. That usually winds up taking place at my house. But part of the problem is we're slightly more spread out this year in that the person who's running programming this year used to live in Columbia where I live and now lives in Philadelphia. So we're not quite as easy to schedule that meetup this year. And honestly, it's usually 6 to 8 weeks out that we start getting the panel stuff back anyway. So we'll see where it goes. We did change panel heads this year again, so it's a brutal, unforgiving job, and they're doing their best.
Okay.
I don't think you're going to have to wait too much longer.
All right. And just to put a timestamp on this, we are recording this Monday, June 14th. So hopefully, Gerald, your question will be answered by the time you hear this.
Yep.
Okay. Also from Gerald. Has Otakon ever considered a system like Anime Boston's featured panelists that helps pay for the expenses of individuals who do a large number of well-done panels?
Clearly, he's fishing here.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think our best bet with guys like that is to try to drag them onto staff. Honestly, that's it's not my call to make. I mean, typically, there are so many panels. We turn away. There's always people complaining, oh, the panels aren't great or whatever. You know, you can do so much screening and you can do so much effort, but there's a lot of the panels come from the fans. And I do think that good panelists are worth it. But I also think that mixing it up every year gives it a new gives it that freshness so you don't get stale. But I think I've wandered away from the question here.
Basically, is that a program that you would ever consider implementing?
I don't object to it in principle personally. It's not my call. I mean, it's something that programming would need to budget for. And keep in mind that typically it's 2 badges per panel. I think there should be a little something extra maybe for people that are doing multiple panels, but we also try not to have the same 5 people doing a dozen panels.
Which absolutely can happen, as I've seen
at other
conventions.
And don't get me wrong, some of those guys are really good, and they know what they're talking about, and they put a lot of effort into it. And I think it would be nice to do rewards like that. I'll take that back to the programming folks and suggest that. I'm not sure what else we can realistically do, though, because we always have to scramble for hotel rooms for staff and guests. So hotel rooms are very difficult for us to free up. Anybody who's ever tried to book a room for Otakon, you know, after the first of the year already knows that. So hotel space would be the most obvious one. I know maybe a bit of a stipend. I'm not sure how we do that. It gets tricky too for tax stuff. So,
yeah,
but it's something that I'll take back up and make a suggestion that we look at ways to sort of reward featured panelists. I don't think that's a bad idea at all.
Yeah, I mean, you just got to be super careful with it because, I mean, I've seen it where it's a guy, he's got 5 panels over the course of the 3-day con. He's obviously put a lot of time and blood and sweat and tears into 2 of them, and then the other 3 are not so good. I've seen that happen, so you got to be careful about that. On a similar note, he wants to know if something has happened with press recently at Otakon that press will absolutely not give out more than 2 press badges, even if an organization requests more than 2 for interviewing purposes.
It depends on the circumstances. If an organization has been around for a while and has continually produced output, and anybody who's done press for Otakon understands that if it's good or bad, if you're writing about us and you're fulfilling your end of the bargain, that's what we're after. There are people who fairly routinely take us to task over things that we still give press badges to. That's not what it's about. But there is a finite number of them because we have to account for them internally. So we want to make sure that we're not succumbing to the abuse that some organizations have succumbed to. I mean, there are cons that you can go to where there'll be 20 people there supporting, you know, a blogger. And the con maybe thinks that that's a good bargain because they're getting publicity. But, you know, there's like we give away like 200 and some press badges anyway. I don't remember what the total is this year, but you know, I think an organization can make the case, and we certainly do make exceptions to that rule, but you have to make a good case, and you have to make a good case to our press person, who's Alice Wilson. You'll be dealing with her assistant, Lindsay Schneider, pardon me, because Alice is actually having a baby right now.
Okay, then.
Yeah.
A couple of years ago when it was really bad, when people were just abusing the hell out of press privileges, like, you know, they had a LiveJournal page where they talked about anime once or twice and they tried to get in. I remember there was a guy next to me. I asked him, you know, I'll occasionally in the press room, I'll be, oh, what organization are you from? You know, trying to be a little collegiate. And they'll say, oh, I run this blog. And of course, I've never heard of it. And I'll say, oh, what's your readership like? And they're like, oh, I don't know anything about stuff like that. I'm like,
then yeah. why are you – then what the hell – like, you just got in for free. That's – you know?
That's exactly it. There's a lot of people who thought because they wrote a blog, whether anybody read it or not, was immaterial. They were writing a blog, and they were giving us free publicity. I'm like, well, it's not publicity if nobody reads it.
Yeah.
I think that in practice, the pages that people think of when they are looking for news and reviews and things like that, if they can justify it, they don't have a problem with it. You know, we came down hard when we first implemented the policy, but in practice, it's not like you're going to be able to pull one over. I mean, that we see, especially nowadays, we have more people assigned to press and handling that, and I think that they're much more in touch with who's producing stuff. So I would say if you really feel you need another person to make that, then make a compelling case and it'll be considered fairly.
Right. Okay. From AICN Anime, this is Scott Green from Ain't It Cool. There's a perception that it's significantly more difficult for East Coast cons to sign Japanese guests. Is that true? And if so, how have you dealt with it?
Well, the first issue there is a logistics one, is that it takes about 14 hours in a plane to get from Japan to Washington, D.C. And it takes about half that to get to L.A. So my laundry's done, apparently. The first difference is that it's not an entire day of travel. You cut an entire day of travel out, or you add it when you're going to an East Coast con. And what that means is that a guest who has basically decided to come and spend a weekend with us, for which we're grateful, will fly out on Thursday. While they leave, it's Thursday Japan time. They get here after 14 hours in a plane and, you know, a couple of hours in the airport, and then a couple of hours to get from D.C. up to Baltimore, and they've now spent, you know, the last 18 hours in transit, and then they have to do the whole thing again on the way back, and they lose a day when they do it. So they leave on Thursday and they arrive here on Thursday. They leave, say, Monday morning, and they don't get home until Tuesday afternoon. Yeah. So it's more time that they have to take off. And, you know, for a nation of workaholics in an industry that's kind of notorious for working everybody to death, that's difficult sometimes. Where we mostly run into that is with scheduling for, like, Seiyu and some of the musical guests, where they may have, you know, like with Kikuko Inoue last year that plays Belle Dandy, she had a recording session on Monday, so she was only able to come on Friday. You know, we run into that sometimes, and we try to work around it as best we can. But I think it's not that it's more difficult for East Coast cons. It just requires a slightly larger commitment of the guest, and it's less pleasant to travel that long. You know, our biggest competitor for big guests is always going to be the other big con. And they have the weather that you get in L.A. They have the entertainment industry being parked right there. They have all the amenities of L.A. And also they have Disneyland right there. So that's what I get to compete with to try to draw guests.
Right. And so, you have Baltimore.
And we have – well, you know, it's funny that you say that, because the thing we keep hearing from guests is that they like Baltimore because it reminds them of Yokohama and places like that. They like the harbor. They like the fact that the people are friendly. And that's that. I will hold that one up as a – you go to any just run-of-the-mill mom-and-pop diner in Baltimore, and you get the lady with the big hair that looks like she's an extra in a John Waters movie, and she probably was. and, you know, you get, hey, hon, what are you going to have? The crab cakes are really good. And you go to L.A. and you get attitude.
You get fake nice as opposed to down-home, you know, hospitality.
Well, New York, you get attitude.
New York is attitude.
New York, you get attitude. In L.A., you get ignored or you get looked down at. And you know, I don't think that the stereotypes in any of those cases are entirely accurate.
Well, but of course not.
There is a difference in the feel. And I think that we have that, and we have the fact that we try to treat our guests like family. Some of them wind up being more like the crazy family, and some of them wind up being more like the ones that you wish would come and visit more often because they're actually kind of cool. But, you know, if we walk out with our guests remembering that they had a good time and they were treated well, then that's what we've actually built our reputation on among guests and among industry, is we hope that we send them out here wanting to come back.
Do you have any crazy guest blind items you could give us? Like just someone who's completely taken advantage of you?
I really have
to think. Or just been a dick. Yeah, I'm sure there are ones that are just total dicks, because I hear some stories too.
You know, you'd think that. I mean, you'd think that you run into that more. I mean, I have to be honest. I've been a little picky about who we've got. I mean, one of our big advantages is that we have connectors in the industry that will give us the scoop on a particular guest. One of the guests that we considered this year is a pretty big name voice actor. And we were, and I'm not going to name names, but we were basically told that he will probably show up with the expectation of being taken out to strip clubs and stuff like that. And I said, well, that's not the way we do it. And
why not, Jim?
Well, it's not that we wouldn't do that. It's that I just don't want to set the expectation that it's going to be a free-for-all drunken party all weekend. Uh-huh. Now, you've been to where the guests are, and you know that it's fun and it's relaxed, but it's never, oh my God, it was the wildest party ever. It's not, that's not what we're trying to create. We want to make it so that people, that when the guests come, they're able to interact with the fans, because that's what they're there for. They're not there for me to come and hang out in the room with and drink all night. Though that happens. It's about making the experience right for everybody. And someone whose main thing is to get a free weekend to booze and it up is not going to be a good guest.
Right.
But as far as, I don't know, I mean, you occasionally get, you know, I get the hotel bill, so I see who rented porn. And that's always amusing. It's not always who you expect it to be. But, you know, who raids the minibar and who doesn't. You know, there's stuff like that. But I can't think of anybody who's been actually downright rude. There have been some guests who were a little standoffish. But we usually wind up winning them over. I honestly can't think of any that were actually to the problem level, even enough to talk about under veiled circumstances. I can't think of anybody that's really been a problem. We've really had a good luck with that.
Hmm. Well, that's good.
Wow. Very lucky.
The managers for musical guests can occasionally be a pain in the butt.
Yeah,
that's pretty much a universal thing. Is the guest is never the problem. Their handlers sometimes are.
Yeah.
Right.
They'll have delusions of grandeur. We have had a guest or two whose personal assistant or helper or editor or whatever just thought that everything needed to revolve around them. And beyond that, I don't think we've ever – I mean, the guest himself was fine, and the handler, we just kind of worked around as best we could. I've actually had a guest apologize to me for their handler's behavior once, which was really weird. But again, no details. Sorry.
Yeah. No, that's actually very common among anyone. It's a celebrity. It's their handlers, their managers, their agents. Those are the people that are the problem. Okay. From X Stylist, do you, you've already pretty much answered the first part, but the second part's interesting. Do you guys have ugly internal convention drama, and what's your secret to keeping it out of public view?
Well, I alluded to one of them. You know, we have lots of, especially the people that tend to be running cons, especially bigger cons, and especially older cons, tend to be opinionated and pushy and very confident in their decisions. And that's often a very useful trait. But you get a bunch of the people, like if we have had situations where the arguments got quite heated, and sometimes over stuff that I would say is quite silly. And we've had people stomp out of rooms, and we've had people go off and sulk for a year and then come back. And we've also had people that got mad and never came back. And I think there's a recognition among our staff that the thing that we're all part of is bigger than anybody's individual ego. I mean, I've had words with people that are now valuable staffers with me, even within my own section. And we've had some knockdown, drag out, you know, lasting months long arguments, because that's what you do when you have to get something done. And that's what you do when you have people with strong opinions. I think that's inevitable. I think that it doesn't get aired as publicly because part of our structure enforces the need to listen to everyone. You can't just make a decision and get away with it. We were drafting disciplinary policy because, you know, you get to a certain side and you have to have that. And you have to have a way to remove someone from staff when they need to be removed from staff, which happens pretty rarely. But we needed a clean way to do it and a policy to follow to do it right. And, you know, it took us, I don't know, a year to write it. And one of the things that is in the final draft of that is an explicit reminder that if the general voting membership always has the ability to overrule decisions, because we basically set it up so that if someone really does, the I'm kind of going off on a tangent here, but the rule is that if someone does something bad enough, then the executive committee can basically kick them out, deal with it right away, and it's done. But it has to be confirmed by the entire voting membership. And what that does is it prevents people's individual vendettas from taking over. And it also means that there's always a check on power. So, you know, with not having the president of the corporation is a one-year term, and the most of the executive staff for Oda Corp are term limited to like 2 or 3 years, depending on the role. So, and you can only serve, I think, 5 or 6 years in the board consecutively. So there's built-in churn and there's built-in mechanisms for new people to come in, but there's always that check that anything that the board does can be overturned by the whole committee. Does that answer any of that question, or did I just kind of wander off on a tangent?
No, I think that makes sense.
I think that our rules, our bylaws were written by people who had that happen to them. And so there's a lot of protection to prevent star chambering and just vendettas from being in there from the get-go. So I think once you've had something like that happen to you and been on the receiving end for it, you're much more sensitive to it. So there's perhaps a little too much of that in our bylaws, but I really can't argue with the results.
No, you gotta. I mean, especially when nobody's being paid, you know.
Yeah.
When you're paying people, you know, that whole dynamic changes.
About that, we actually have, I think on 3 separate occasions, we basically voted in a budget line item for at least one paid staffer who would basically be answering the phones and operating up in an office to deal with the stuff that, you know, I can't make a phone call during the business day or whatever, and dealing with all that and dealing with all the paperwork. And every time we wound up not doing it because people would step up and finally volunteer, and nobody wanted to break that seal, you know?
Well, who wants to be the only guy getting paid? That's just an invitation to resentment.
Well, there's that, but I mean, we had kind of worked ourselves up to the point where we could see paying an administrative assistant to be basically a full-time secretary for the con. Mm. And then we looked at getting those office services that'll do that for you, where you have basically a call center that you can call into and a place to handle your mail and everything.
In India. And
well, no. Like temp services will do that sometimes the virtual office places, and a lot of those places would also have, like, you know, you get meeting room space and so forth with that. But we wound up talking ourselves out of it every time. And there's always something else that we can use, you know, $50,000 for. Because that's pretty much the bare minimum that it's going to cost to employ somebody.
Next up, we've only got a couple left here. From Alex Leavitt, will we see a decline in anime con organization in the next 5 years? My theory is that there's no next generation of anime-loving staffers that care enough to do it.
Oh, that's a mixed question, because if you'd asked me a couple times over the last couple of years, I'd have said, I really fear that all anime cons are going to collapse under their own weight because there aren't new staffers stepping up. What? I'm sorry. Noisy cat.
We don't mind. It's fine. We've had meowing before. It's not a big deal.
Yeah. What people that run sci-fi things have cats? Never. No, but every now and again, just when you're kind of on the verge of losing hope, you'll see a couple of really cool new staffers step up to the plate and be awesome. And, you know, that's kind of been motivating a lot of people this year to make sure that they have picked an assistant and that they're offloading duties to the assistant, because it also prevents burnout. But it also gives you a little bit of hope to see that, you know, this new awesome staffer is grabbing responsibility and then fulfilling it. So I'm less worried about it right now than I have been at times in the past.
From Fist of the MFK, anime cons around the country are becoming less focused on anime and branching out to other fandoms. How do you feel about that?
Every year I get a lot of grief from people because I don't bring webcomics anymore and I don't bring other types of guests. There was a period when everybody wanted me to bring William Hung because, oh, ha, ha, lol, it's funny. Or can you bring this internet celebrity or whatever? And I'm like, I think that's when it helps to have a very, very clear mission. And our mission is to use pop culture as a gateway to broader cultural understanding. That's kind of the phrasing slightly different than that, but that's really what it is. You get you hooked on your ninjas and your harem shows, and the next thing you know, you've actually learned something about a culture that's not your own. And it really does work. And I think at the end of the day, each con is its own beast. They all have their own reasons to exist, And sometimes that works out really well. Like, I'm a huge webcomics fan. I love webcomics. And I have, you know, friends that do them. I have people who I really admire who have put out some excellent work out there. And I'm a comic book fan from way back. So yet another nerd feather in my multi-plumed cap at this point. But I think that it's great that Kineticon has kind of stepped up and become the de facto East Coast webcomics con. Mm-hmm. They've filled a niche, and that's great. And it's something that we couldn't do, even though if you walk into our artist alley, you'll see dozens of webcomics there. I'm thrilled by that because then I can walk down and say, oh my God, that strip was awesome last week, and I find that fun. But it's not about East Asian culture. It's not something that we can spend a lot of effort or money or focus on. The zombie apocalypse panel is fun, but it's one panel among dozens and hundreds, actually. So I think I like the 10% rule. If you've got more than 10% of something that's not what you're about at your con, it's okay. But when you start getting beyond that, it starts becoming a slippery slope. And you don't want to become a generic con because there are already a bunch of those.
Yeah, I would imagine it gets kind of irritating after a while. And you just have to tell people, like, look, please stop making suggestions because you think it's funny. Like, that's going to be funny for 2 seconds.
Yeah, I cannot imagine who in their right mind would want to hear anything that Hard Gay or William Hung has to say.
Yeah, that's just a terrible idea. I think it's funny in their heads for like 2 seconds, and they get past it. You know,
well, yeah, it's funny in the haha, I've had too many Cheetos, and I'm watching late night talk shows way.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So finally, we're going to end on two very lighthearted questions here from Kyokun 703. For the Otakon people, have you ever cosplayed or wish you could? And if you could, who would you cosplay as?
I'm actually going to cosplay as myself this year, which is technically valid since I am now a character in an anime. yeah, it's not going to be that big of a deal. But I actually go to a Doctor Who convention every year, and floating around on the net is a picture of me in a Time Lord outfit.
Really?
But at Otakon, I'm too busy. And I'm also a big guy. I'm not hugely fat, but the heat and I do not get along, and I'm pretty much on the go for the entire con. So the thought of wearing a costume while racing from one end of the convention center to the other, which is about a half mile, does not hold much appeal.
Oh. Not to mention almost every anime character is a, you know, wafer-thin teenager.
Yeah, I could cosplay, the big guy from Voltron is pretty much my limits. I am kind of looking forward to Thor, though, because then there'll be a big blonde bearded guy that I can cosplay as easily.
There we go.
Just have to put on some muscle.
Oh, real quick, I did want to ask you, I want to slip this in. Has the steampunk stuff started invading Otakon?
It's been there for years.
Yeah.
I don't mind it so much. And the whole cosplay thing, I mean, there's a whole side of that that is just people showing up in crazy costumes. And, you know, more power to them. If it's fun for them, whatever. I like that our masquerade has some rules on that. You know, if you want to participate in the contest, it's got to be relevant.
Yeah.
I've seen one too many Jack Sparrows. I've seen one too many people getting out their Ren Faire outfits. And, you know, I understand the escapist value of it, but you don't go to a Star Trek con and cosplay as someone from Lord of the Rings, really. And I don't understand why, with such a broad palette to choose from, people would go and pull out their same tired Halloween costumes.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't think it's a problem. It's just – it kind of leaves me wondering why.
Attention. That's why. They just want attention.
I don't think that's actually it. I think that may be part of it for some people, but I think it's part of that way that people who aren't entirely comfortable in their skin find a skin to be comfortable in.
Yeah, like this is the one safe place where I can let this part of myself out.
Exactly. And if that means that the Captain Jack, you know, there's a guy that comes every year that looks scarily like Kevin Smith, the director, you know, and he shows up in a Silent Bob outfit all the time. He looks just like Silent Bob. And every time I see him, I have to do a double take. He knows that. He's kind of run with it. It's an easy costume. It's kind of fun. And there's at least some geek credibility to that. So I really don't blame him. But I do wonder, you know, if I ever bump into Kevin Smith, you know damn well I'm going to say, hey, you should stop by. So it would be awesome if they actually bumped into each other somewhere.
All right. Finally, and this is for all three of us and is completely unrelated to anything.
Oh, God.
What is the most embarrassing song or group you'll admit to having on your iPod or other music device?
Ooh.
Justin, you'll probably be a whopper on this one.
Holy shit. Probably... Oh, I have a lot of really terrible music, but probably the worst one is the mid-90s German happy hardcore band Blümchen.
Which song would that be, sir?
I have a few.
Because I know one of their songs was pretty popular for a while. It was like a one-hit wonder type song, but they were actually big in Germany for a while, weren't they?
Yeah,
but they were like on Sesame Street. Like, every German person I've ever talked to about Blümchen was basically reacted like I just told them that I have a Justin Bieber poster on my wall. Let's see, what have I got here? Here's Octobahn, here's Nürgertheimt, there's Übermorgenland. Yeah, I have a couple really terrible. Half of my music collection is horrendous, and the other half is pretty awesome, and they kind of cancel each other out. That's what my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Jim?
You want to go next, Zach?
I'll go next, and my shit is repulsive to, like, Justin's is sort of ha-ha ironic. My shit is, like, my secret shame is shit like Katy Perry and Kesha and music that I heard on The Hills.
Jesus. I'll admit I have one Katy Perry song, but I have not succumbed to Kesha.
And it's chiefly just because it gets stuck in my head. I mean, that stuff is manufactured to get stuck in your head. But I'm a grown man and probably shouldn't have that shit on my iPod.
I have to admit, we went to karaoke last week, and was it Bamboo that sang the Justin Bieber song?
Yeah.
And I actually liked the song. I will still never download that song, but I actually did like it.
I have very recently become a won over to Lady Gaga. I have yet to get anything of hers on my actual iPod, but that's because she hasn't shown up alphabetically yet, and I haven't actually bought the CD. I've been slowly loading my music collection into iTunes, and I'm up through the eyes. And I probably have amongst the most eclectically broad. I mean, when I go on Shuffle, people go, "Really? Really? Really? You have both of those on the same computer without it blowing up?" I have, like, Renaissance Fair music groups, and then, you know, Otakon musical guests I frequently have on my iPod just because, you know, I have the CDs, and, oh, that was a fun performance. But, you know, I like 90s dancey pop crap. I like whiny emo stuff from that era.
Do you have any Enya?
I'll have you know that not only do I have Enya, I have Enya before she branched off on her own, because I was a big fan of the musical group Clannad.
Oh, yes.
Who started off doing traditional Irish music, and she was a singer along with her sister, Mara Brennan.
Dude, I have her Laserdisc.
I have it on vinyl.
Oh, you win.
I have it on vinyl along with all of the band's original albums on vinyl upstairs somewhere.
Oh, my God.
Do you know what else I have on vinyl? Joan Jett and the Blackhearts' I Love Rock and Roll on a 45.
Now, see, that's awesome.
Yeah.
That's the, like, shout from the rooftop, "See, I have good taste in music."
The only 45s I own are that one, and I couldn't tell you what the B-side is. I could at one point, but I don't remember it. It's been so long since I've owned a turntable. I have that. I have a Doctor Who song when they took it off the air, and they did Doctor in Distress as sort of a rallying call. It was a Doctor Who protest song, essentially, saying, "BBC, please bring it back." And I have a 45 of the Oak Ridge Boys singing Elvira.
Jesus.
Okay, then.
So, yeah, it will be hard to outweird me for record collection stuff. But, yeah, we should totally compare. Are you going to be at Otakon this year, guys?
I will not.
I know Zach won't, but he won't even Skype because he hates us.
I wanted to, but, A, I don't have the funds because I have 3 weddings this fall.
Oh, I remember those years.
Yeah, 3 weddings, and then I have it's been a bad year.
Are you in the weddings?
One of them.
Yeah,
maybe two.
I was in 4 weddings in 1 year once.
Yeah.
And it was the year 4 weddings and a funeral came out, So that was a big topic of discussion.
That joke never got old, I'm sure.
Not by the fourth wedding, no. If I'd bought a tux like at the beginning of that year, I would be like $300 less poor than I was. And that was when I was at college. That was real money then.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Okay, man. Well, that's all we had for you. Thank you so much for joining us. And,
yeah, that was
and
a lot of fun.
Yeah.
There's one other thing I forgot to tell you guys.
Okay.
I'll tell you because we're probably going to be announcing it tomorrow. But before you tack this on at the end as a special treat or however you want to squeeze it in, X-Japan will be playing Lollapalooza the week after Otakon. So Yoshiki and Sugizo are going to come and do a special intimate performance during the masquerade.
Cool.
Holy cow.
That's cool.
Yep. That's the one that basically Yoshiki wanted to do something with us again, and we've been trying to find the right opportunity, and he decided to do it this way. And so we'll have them coming. They'll do like a little Q&A moderated thing during the halftime, and we'll be doing a thing for you can submit questions, and we'll be giving away tickets to Lollapalooza and all kinds of fun stuff.
Okay, that's our show. Thanks again to Jim for joining us. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on iTunes. And as always, we will see you next week. Warning. Do not watch Heat Guy J if you take nitrates, often prescribed for chest pain, as this may cause a sudden and unsafe drop in blood pressure. Discuss your general health status with your doctor to ensure that you're healthy enough to watch Heat Guy J. If you experience chest pain, nausea, or any other discomforts while watching Heat Guy J, seek immediate medical help. In the rare event that you watch Heat Guy J for more than 4 hours, seek immediate medical help to avoid long-term injury.